Good evening. My name is Peter Berg. I'm head of special collections here in the MSU Libraries. I would like to welcome you to another evening of the Michigan Writers Series. Our guest tonight is Keith Taylor. Keith Taylor is one of our state's best known and most respected writers. Just last year, he wrote two acclaimed books, Guilty at the Rapture, a collection of poems and stories that won a 2007 Michigan Notable Book Award, and Batter Guitars, the poetry and prose of Kostas Kariotakis, a book he translated with his friend William Reeder. Over the years, Taylor has worked and appeared in numerous places, ranging from The Story to the Los Angeles Times, from Birdwatcher's Digest to the Chicago Tribune to Michigan Quarterly Review, Poetry Ireland, and the Southern Review. Taylor has won awards for his work here and in Europe and coordinates the undergraduate program in creative writing at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. And I'm pleased to say Keith was here with us for our inaugural season in the winter of 1999. So we're most pleased to welcome him back tonight. Will you please join me in welcoming Keith Taylor?
Thank you, Peter. So do I need both of these things, John?
Yeah.
Okay. We have to do this for the electronics. Otherwise, I'd come out there and mingle with you. So just imagine me mingling. It's good to be back, particularly this week. On Monday, I sent off the manuscript for my next book of poems, which is going to be published. Well, it's under contract anyway. They still have it out. Let's hope they don't exercise it. With Wayne State University Press, which book will be out in the spring of 2009. And I had to have it to them by October 1st, and I had it to them by October 1st. So, of course, that's most of what I want to read from tonight is from this new book, since some of the stuff I haven't paraded out in public before, which is it's good to do. So I might start with that. I also wanted to make sure that I didn't repeat any poems that I read here in 1999, since it all goes on the web, and it was like, oh, yeah, sure, he just keeps reading the same poem over and over again. So I never, as a matter of fact, the title of this book... that came out, not the Book of Translations, but the other book that came out last year, Guilty at the Rapture, was a poem that when I went today to look at the archive, the MSU archive, I actually saw that, yes, indeed, I did read it here, so I can't read that poem, even though it's in a new book, but it existed in 1999, I think in slightly different form. So I'll start with the first book poem in this new book, and it's a poem about not wanting to go to work. The 8:35 bus. Our mornings won't always be like this. Soon we'll find a little place to rent out west of town, plant an acre garden, and stay home to fight invading aphids. We'll build a cabin up north where snow will keep us in for weeks, feed evening grosbeaks, and learn the proper way to bank a fire in our peacock stove. We'll sail the North Atlantic from Newfoundland to Iceland and the Hebrides, then tan slowly on beaches next to bodies that will never know one day of work. We'll measure the semicircle a falcon makes, migrating past our castle in Spain. We will eat the golden peaches in Samarkand. That poem's kind of old now. My wife, when I was working on this book, and the poems were scattered around the kitchen table, and she looked at this and she said, "Our mornings are still like that." I was like, oh, well, I fell down. The funny thing about poems, though, you do poems and you think, okay, that's a poem about not wanting to go to work. That's what it is in my mind. I just found out that some friends of mine read this out in Maine, read this to their parents for their 60th wedding anniversary. And for them, it was a poem about all the possibilities that would be present for these people who were 80 years old who could still go out and do things. And I was like, wow, I thought it was just a poem about not wanting to go to work. It's kind of cool. And the thing about being a poet is you don't mind that, you know? Whatever you can get out of it, you go for. I've tried to do lots of different kinds of things in my poetry over the years, and I'm not one of those people who is sort of beats the drum about formal poems, and you have to do formal poems, and poems from the old received forms and meter. But every now and then I like to play around with it. Usually I don't publish it, and usually it's not very good, which is why I don't publish it. But it sort of keeps the juices flowing, and I sort of call them finger exercises, like pianists doing scales or whatever. But here's one, a villanelle, which is a tough form with a lot of complex repetitions in it. You can Google it if you don't know the form and find out about it, but you'll hear lines repeated all the way through. And I tried maybe 100 of them in my life, and I finally found one I kind of like. And it was kind of light. I think that's why it worked for me. I wasn't trying to do anything too fancy. So this is the first villanelle of mine that I'm sort of keeping in the public eye, whichever public wants to raise an eye and look at it. So this is called My Exercise Plan. I like to talk about my morning walk, even though I bore everyone I know. Whether into work or just around the block in pre-dawn dark at sunrise or 9 o'clock, it's one time I'm part of the usual flow. So I will talk about my morning walk, but it should not come as a profound shock to learn that I don't actually get up and go into work or even just around the block, not every day anyway, despite my talk. And when I do, I move real slow. I mostly talk about my morning walk because that's easier than the walk itself up Washington to Maine like some normal Joe going to work or just around the block. Besides, I sweat as much as the wannabe jock running past me at State and Liberty. No, I like to talk about my morning walk, whether into work or just around the block. So, yeah, you can tell my exercise plan is not having a great effect yet. We still hold out hope that someday it's going to kick in and change my life, but it hasn't happened yet. There's a wonderfully famous poet abroad in the world right now. She actually, when she settles down and lives in one place, she's living in Ann Arbor now. She's a Canadian. Her name is Anne Carson. You may know her work. Anne was trained as a classicist, and her poems all have a lot of classical allusions and classical connections, although her poems are often very cutting edge, feel very avant-garde and very much out there. She's kind of shy. She doesn't talk to people a whole lot, and she doesn't reveal a lot about herself. For years, the biographical notice on her books are published by Knopf, and they go everywhere, and the biographical notice on her book said, Anne Carson lives in Canada. Well, now she lives in Michigan, although at this particular moment, she's in Berlin. Anne overheard me one day talking to somebody about some owls that I found out south of Ann Arbor. So she said, oh, I want to see these owls. So I said, sure, I'd love to take you to see the owls. So I took her out to see the owls. And on the way, of course, she just kept looking at the Latin names in the bird book going, oh, in Latin, this means this, and this means this. And so it was kind of fun. So I wrote this poem, which has a very sort of suburban Michigan feel to it, intentionally so, but it's dedicated to Anne Carson, which is kind of weird. All that's for a very short and simple poem. The title of the poem is At the Wendy's East of Saline. Behind the back parking lot of the fast food restaurant, close to the factory that makes molded plastic parts, bumpers, knobs, and cup holders for the big Ford pickup truck, in a scrubby stand of oaks next to a subdivision of vinyl-sided houses, a great horned owl peers over the edge of her nest, seemingly unperturbed, as if she's been watching there for 2,000 or 3,000 years. I was just telling the woman who interviewed me that I'm sort of intrigued lately by doing some longer poems, since I've done a lot of short poems in my life, just like that one. The first way of getting to longer poems is to make them a sequence of short poems. So that's what this is. This is a sequence of short poems. There'll be a couple references to things in here that I'll get back to, but I don't think there's anything you have to know going into it. The poem is all constructed on if clauses, so conditional clauses, if this were to happen, then this were to happen, or maybe this would happen. And that's where the title of the sequence comes, conditions. If I jumped, would I keep my eyes open, look down at the ground coming up fast, or would I close them, feel nothing but the wind rush past my ears, blowing out loose strands of hair? If I'd gone bad, and I could have, and if I'd survived, which is less certain, I would be fatter, hairier, dirtier. I'd be loud in public places. I'd be drunk by 8 and act as if the world loved me, only me. If I'd chosen to live like my friend Steve, I might be eulogized by a farmer who would tell the congregation how I drove out to the back field behind the woods through grass taller than my car one early fall morning, just to talk. If I touched the sap on the spruce out back and left a print or a bit of fingernail, some loose skin, it might settle, harden until the tree dies, compress, become stone, get carried away by new rivers or unimaginable explosions, and a different being in a different world might find it millions of years from now and polish it for a piece of amber jewelry to decorate a child's bracelet or the collar for some new pet. If the offering we made to Pele, volcano goddess, at the edge of Halemaumau on Kilauea, a small cairn and tobacco from a broken cigarette, doesn't work, will the piece of lava, only 1 inch by 2 from a recent flow, 1984, I think, that sits now with other stones in a basket on top of our television, bring bad luck, or worse yet, start glowing some quiet evening, calling up its brothers and sisters from the Earth's hot core to join in a Midwestern fire? If the world becomes so bright we can't see the stars, will they become stories like mythical wars or old gods? Or will we, all of us, the whole world, plan festivals, say, 6 hours long on the 6th new moon of each bright year when we turn off all our lights, every single bulb, and dance quietly beneath temporary stars? If Bill died, which has not happened, at least not yet, I would be upset, probably. I'd cry, would have trouble sleeping for days because I wouldn't have told him that of my memories, one of the best is staying up too late in Greece, Olympia, drinking ouzo, Bill, Christine, me, and arguing all night about apocalypse, explosions, the end of the world. Bill was certain it would happen soon, maybe on the coming bright Peloponnesian morning, and I wasn't so sure, thought we might just bumble through some millennia still, and a tired Englishman knocked on our door and said, "Yes, I'm fascinated. I'm enjoying every word, every word." If all this longing for the end of the world, the end of time, whatever, is just a psychological quirk, a head trick, and the crumpled pages from Shakespeare never do blow across a dry and lifeless planet, what will happen? Just the same old worries about feeding the children, washing dishes, mortgage payments, and what will we do tomorrow? If I forget everything when I'm old, my wife, my daughter, all the years of work and travel, what will remain? One day, perhaps, when I sat with my friend Dave, and he is already many years gone, below the walls at Carcassonne, and we ate bread and cheese and sausage that we sliced with a jackknife. My friend cut his finger, and we saw a dead rat in the grass. If I sat in one place long enough, looking out, not in, I would see many things, not everything, but what came would be its own adventure, cement cracking under the slow pressure of weeds, children growing, and the birds, of course, coming and going, flying over or picking bugs from my toes. If I had the tongues of angels, what would I say? I do this, I do that, here's my family, here's my house, here's how I get my living. Occasionally, days come when there's nothing better in this expanding universe than cherry cobbler. If I see my daughter in the daylight world as I saw her in my dream, grown, smiling, and ruddy, standing in a corral, holding reins, her hair wind-blowing, will it be my last sight? Will it be enough? The fascination I had with, as a sort of young wannabe bohemian, with Europe, and this was now 35 years ago, and so I went. I quit college after my first year and went to France and learned languages and studied and had no money and was penniless and it was wonderful. I was in love for the first time and all those things. It was great. I mean, it was part of some sort of thing that I don't think a lot of people have now. It was some sort of vestige of the 20s. You know, it was still 50 years after that fact. It was still there. I'm going to go and I'm going to be, you know, Hemingway and Pound and Eliot. And, you know, I'm going to have that life, which, of course, was 50 years in the past. But it was still pretty good. And it sort of connected with some fascinations that I had, mostly because it was so different than my life, rural, religious, isolated background that I came from. So I want to read you a couple of poems about memories of Europe. First one is about that first girlfriend. There are some writers in the middle of this that some of you will know and some of you will not recognize, and don't worry about it. They're just sort of European writers that I was reading at the time. There's also a bunch of American writers that are mentioned, and most of those will be more familiar to you. So, days of 1971, 1972. Between my nights washing dishes at the restaurant, one star in the Michelin, where rich folks from Toulouse ate their quiet country dinners, and my afternoons on the ledge below the eaves outside my little room above the private riding club, the ledge that looked south across green hills to the Pyrenees, and where I sat for 8 months and read the expected Europeans, Céline, of course, Baudelaire, Cavafy in the small prose fragments of his French translation, and for the first time understood what it was about the Americans, Poe, Melville, Whitman, Henry Miller, how they could be sad and exuberant on the same page, and how right that sounded to me. In the mornings between my job and the reading, she would come back, often just at dawn, when the nightingales still called from the far horse pasture, before the black mountains had whitened under their warm Iberian sun. She would come back, tired and smelling of her other, more experienced lovers, and would wake me, sometimes gently caressing my beard or bringing me back to her hard world by quietly ripping pages from my books and dropping them on me like a blanket. It was not a marriage made in heaven. It was never a marriage, but the relationship did not last. As this one might indicate, just a little one, and not really in verse, more like in sentences. They're sort of just set up on the page like independent, discrete sentences. This is called My Education in Paris. An Icelandic woman named Augusta said she wouldn't sleep with me because I was too short. I had never asked. A Greek woman, blonder than Augusta, said she wouldn't sleep with me because I was too thin. I wanted to ask her, but was too shy. A young Persian woman whose name meant little white flower that grows in the desert, at least that's what she told me, and I wanted to believe her, said she wouldn't sleep with me because I was too old. I was 22 and hadn't asked her either. A French woman I did ask said she was very pleased, but she preferred women. So there's enough about my sexual humiliation in Europe. We won't go into any more of those, although, of course, I have more of those. The process of sending me there was of course, a result of my reading, and this goes back a little bit in time when I was first bitten by some of that reading. And oddly enough, for no reason that I can figure out, other than the fact that my father read the New Testament in the original Greek, so we had Greek around the house, but of course, by that time, I was already trying to distance myself from that background. I was reading them, you know, modern Greeks, so I was obsessed with them and read a lot of them in translation when I could find them in translation. The translations have always come in and out of print. So this remembers back to when, you know, I was 15, so a long time ago. I did indeed learn a little bit of modern Greek, studied it in my late 40s at U of M. They let me sit in on the introduction to Greek, modern Greek classes. So I've dedicated this poem to my modern Greek teachers. I just like saying their names. So this poem is for Vasilis Lambropoulos, Artemis Leontis, and Kostalena Mikalaki. Those names are poems in and of themselves. This poem ends on a Greek word. It's one of the most beautiful Greek words, one of the oldest. No one's quite sure where it comes from. It's the Greek word for the sea. Ithalassa. An Introduction to Modern Greek in South Bend, Indiana, 1967. Quince and pomegranate, sage, rosemary. I didn't know anyone who even knew what those things were. So at Benner's Market on Mishawaka Avenue, right next to our new temple, the Gospel Center United Missionary Church, I bought pistachio nuts, a product of Greece, and Welch's white grape juice. I carried them like holy food to Pottawatomi Park, where at picnic tables below oaks I read Zorba the Greek. I was 15, and there had never been a loneliness or a longing as exquisite as mine. I wandered over dusty hills in Crete, slaking my thirst with Welches. I sauntered through dark alleys in the medieval town on roads built by the Knights Hospitaller after Saladin conquered Jerusalem, and smelled souvlaki grilling over fire, eating pistachios to satisfy my hunger. When lake effect snow began to drift down from the sullen skies above South Bend, I discovered Odysseus Elitus and learned that in those poems was some new place. But I walked there in the sun on a beach sprinkled with white and black pebbles, while a slightly older, dark-haired, olive-skinned woman who whispered just above the Aegean's gentle wash, Ithalassa, Thalassa, Thalassa. So the interesting Greek stuff, many years later, and after a firm friendship had been established with William Reeder, who's the Bill who did not die in that previous poem, and he's the guy who laughed about that poem, so he's sitting right there. Bill teaches religion up at Central North of here, and Bill discovered this writer that was very important to Greeks that I'd never heard about, and I knew more about modern Greek literature than most dilettantes did, and there was very little of his work in English, so we spent 10 years putting this guy into English. The book was just published in England a few months ago. I want to read you some of his poems. A little bit about him. His name is Kostas Kariatakis. He really did look like this, sort of this intense, brooding young man. The poems are very bleak. He was not filled with a lot of hope, although he laughed at himself a lot. So they're kind of bleak with this wry sense of humor, like, aren't I stupid being so depressed all the time? He then did kill himself at the age of 32. In 1928. Well, that's an interesting story in and of itself. So this guy had never really existed in English before, so Bill and I started working on this. It was great work. We worked pretty hard, got together whenever we could. We did have a lovely residency on the island of Rhodes, where we were able to do some more of this work. So I'm just going to read you three of the Kariatakis poems, and there are not many people in our language who've ever heard these before, so, for whatever reason, be happy, although you can't be too happy reading these poems. So don't get depressed. The first one is a poem he wrote when he was probably 19 years old, maybe 20. So it's a tiny little poem, and it's called Love. He wrote his own little epigraphs for these first poems. So this is in his. It's a different voice than the poems, but it's still his voice. So Love, and I was in the darkness, and I was the darkness, and a ray of light found me. Her shining face was a fine dew, and I a parched asphodel. Her youthfulness shook me awake. My lips, gone bitter, laughed, as if her eyes had told me I'd no longer be shipwrecked alone. I submitted to her tenderness, I, whom pain had turned to stone. So that was when he was 19, and again, he didn't live very long. So that next one is a poem he wrote probably in his mid-20s. You're never satisfied with these projects, and they never get done, and you're always sort of thinking you could change them. And so at some point, you just have to say, stop. But this is one I think Bill and I actually got pretty close on this one. We got something close to his form, and I like the images. The images sound good in our language, and they're close to his images. So the poem is called Sleep. Will the gift and good fortune be granted to us that one night we can go to die there on the green shore of our native land? Sweetly we shall sleep like little children, sweetly. And up above us all the stars, all worldly things will drift into the sky. Just like a dream, the wave will caress us, and as blue as a wave, our dream will draw us to far countries which do not exist. The breezes will flow like love in our hair. The seaweed's breath will leave its scent on us, and down below our now heavy eyelids, without noticing, we shall wear a smile. The roses will move down from the hedges, and they'll come to us to be our pillow. The nightingales will give up their own sleep to make sleep more harmonious for us. Sweetly, we shall sleep like little children. Sweetly. And the young girls of our village will stand all around us like wild pear trees. And bending down, they will whisper to us about golden cabins, about the sun on Sunday, about snow-white flower pots, about our good years, which are all gone now. A little old woman will hold our hand, and while we are slowly closing our eyes, she, pale, will tell us like a fairy tale of the bitterness of life. And the moon will descend to be a candle at our feet when for the last time we shall fall asleep there on the green shore of our native land. Sweetly, we shall sleep like little children who have cried all day, exhausting themselves. I warned you that there's, you know, I warned you about it. Here's one that's a slightly, a little, you know, slightly more, slightly lighter. So he always made fun of himself, and he always made fun of literary aspirations, his and everyone else's, which is very typical of the Greeks, because, you know, modern Greek, although we all think the Greeks and, you know, Socrates and Plato and Aristotle and all the old ancient Greeks and everything, but modern Greece has been a country of great turmoil, and it's a small country. There are probably only 9 or at most 10 million speakers of that language in the world, which is, you know, not a lot of speakers. There are more people than that in the state of Michigan. You know, they cling to it, and they make fun of themselves when they have literary aspirations, but nonetheless, they've done pretty well for themselves. So this is a little poem he wrote about his career. He mentions a poet in here, Clearetta Dipla Melamu. She was basically sort of known sort of only as writing sort of silly doggerel verse. There's a bookshop, Vasilio Bookshop, which really did exist, and where all the bohemian types would go and hang out. I think that's all that's a little weird about Athens in 1923. Career. My flesh and blood I'll put in the folio form of a book. His verses show promise, is what the daily press will write. Clearetta Dipla Melamu, and next to hers, my name too. I'll give myself body and soul once more to work and to toil. But when the sun sinks low, to the Vasilio bookshop I'll go. There I'll find all the others, the literati and the tutors. My words will have substance, my silence significance. Looking for things that last, I'll let the years go past. They'll pass, and my heart will become like a rose that I've trampled upon. So that's enough of Kyriakos. That's about as light as he gets. I'll forego the pleasure of reading you the last poem, which is a wonderful poem that he wrote just before he killed himself. And it's funny. I mean, it's even kind of funny. Even his suicide note is funny. I mean, it's weird. We translated his suicide note in the book, and it sort of does and sort of says, you know, say goodbye to my parents and all that. And then he's got a P.S. on his suicide note. And the P.S. goes, if you ever try to kill yourself by drowning yourself, make sure you don't know how to swim. I just spent all night out in the sea battling the waves, sometimes just my mouth above the water, and it didn't work. So I came back, and I went and I bought, you know, showered, changed, bought myself a gun, and now I'm writing this before I go out to shoot myself. And it's like, this is a suicide note? You know, if you want to kill yourself by water, make sure you don't know how to swim. and then he also says at the end of that, he says he's going to do all this, but at the end he says, sooner or later, I'll write an essay about it. And, you know, he's dead within 15 minutes, so go figure. Hard to believe I got to love, Bill and I both got to love Kyriakos, but we did. I'm going to read one tiny little prose thing. It's longer than a real short, but it's not quite as long as a real short story. And this gets us back, from Europe and Greece back to the Midwest, although it's a fanciful Midwest. I figured I should do this just so you can see that that this is something else that I do. Doesn't need any explanations. The title comes from the story of Noah's Ark, King James translation, of course, and the title is "And the Waters Prevailed." When I was a child, I loved to water the lawn. In the evenings, I would connect the hoses, turn on the outdoor faucet, and walk all around the yard, giving each inch of grass a good soaking. My parents were amused. I think they were even a little proud of me. At some point, maybe I was 9 or 10, I became interested in how the water flowed. The pressure in the hose fascinated me. I tried to guess how much water could be poured on one spot before the ground became soggy. I measured the distance between the place on the grass where I set the hose and the gutter on the street where, after a few minutes, a thin stream began flowing out of our lawn. A few years later, when I had a bike and was able to disappear for several hours without worrying my parents, I would ride out of our subdivision west on the unpaved roads. I passed the little creeks dredged into straight lines that drained the developments, and farther out, the man-made holding ponds that tried to contain the small springs in the countryside. After 3 or 4 miles, I arrived at a place where the stream still snaked through the fields, starting in or flooding into marshes. Then I would park my bike, climb through the fences, take my shoes off, and walk out into the grasses, the mud, and the water. I didn't mind the bugs. I listened for the trills of the blackbirds and their harsher calls when I got too close to their nests. The buzzing noises of the smaller birds, the wrens and the little warblers, rose from the rushes I pushed aside. Often I heard the deep clacking sounds of the birds who hid around the edge and never flew up when I walked toward them. Occasionally, I watched a muskrat swimming peacefully in the deeper pools, trailing something green from his mouth. Sometimes I would stare for long minutes at my own reflection. It looked perfectly at home, unmoving and quiet. But most of all, I enjoyed the feel of water and mud around my ankles. I pulled my feet out slowly, watching the water swirl in tiny whirlpools when it flowed back into the holes I'd made. Everything else in the marsh was still. I felt this was the way things should be. Back home, I started to think of my yard as a marsh, with mud sucking at my feet and colorful birds flying overhead. At night, I began to look out my second-story window, imagining water rising from the ground, seeping into streets and yards, filling my basements. The houses began to sink, the roads cracked, the ornamental shrubs and pruned maples fell over into the mire. When I was in junior college, my parents were killed in a car accident. They'd gone to a movie while I studied for my introduction to accounting class. They were driving home when they were rear-ended by a semi and pushed over the guardrail. My neighbors were kind. They looked at me sadly, patted me on the back, told me how brave I was. But the house was mine. I could do whatever I needed to do. I finished my associate degree in restaurant management and got a job at the Big Boy out by the freeway. At home, I began looking for the water. I knew right away that it would take a very long time. I couldn't arouse suspicion. I brought my supplies in at night, pumps, generators, pipes, tools, and I never brought too much from the same place. I traveled all over the city, buying some things on the east side, some up in the northern suburbs. I was careful, patient. It took 2 weeks to break through the basement floor. Then I started digging. Late at night, I would put bags of dirt in the trunk of my car, open the automatic garage door, and carry the dirt far into the country. Within a month, I was digging through mud. Soon after, I was knee-deep in water. Then I set the pipe, slowly forcing it down until I hit a pure stream. I tapped the well and began the tunnels. I moved slowly, digging just enough space to slide through on my belly. I shored up the tunnel to protect myself from cave-ins. I often worked without light, comfortably burrowing in the dark. When I hit underground cables on the walls of my neighbor's basements, I veered around or below them. When I got a couple of hundred yards in any direction, I laid my pipes. I get thirsty reading this story. I laid my pipes, starting the sea poles about 50 yards away from my house. Then I slowly filled in the tunnels, packing the dirt tightly around the pipes. When I was done, I sealed my basement walls. The tunnels and pipes took 15 years. The work, several hours in the evening and all day on the weekends or vacations, kept me in good shape, hard and calloused. My coworkers made jokes about what they imagined was my exercise program. I always smiled. I was polite and quiet with my neighbors. They left me alone. When the last of the four pipes was in place, its tunnel filled and sealed, I turned the water on, just a slow trickle at first. I imagined my water seeping into the ground, rising slowly toward the yards. The neighbors didn't begin complaining about leaking basements or soggy spots in their yards until more than 2 years later. When they began to notice, the complaints came from up and down the block, often many houses away from the end of my pipes. Even though I'd spent most of my life thinking about water, I was surprised at how far it managed to spread through the neighborhood. By the time the city fathers decided to do something about the sogginess of our subdivision, I had finished the work inside my house. The first floor windows and doors were reinforced with steel. Late at night, I practiced closing them until everything could be shut tight in less than 10 minutes. In each of the 6 second floor windows, I had carefully assembled and maintained state-of-the-art water cannons, the kind used for construction work, much more powerful than the water cannons used for crowd control. I kept them hidden behind the Venetian blinds. Of course, I was never able to test my cannons, but I felt confident they were ready. On the day the city started testing the ground to find the mysterious source of the wetness, I turned on the water in the pipes full blast. Things changed quickly. In just a few days, my neighbors' lawns started to cave in. The first family left their home on the third day of full force. Their basement was filled and their driveway collapsed. Small springs were sprouting from most of the lawns. Rivulets filled the gutters of the surrounding streets. The streets themselves began to crack. The story of the rising water began to appear in the newspapers. I waited until the heavy equipment arrived. On the morning they started their serious and slightly desperate search for the source of the water, I sealed my house and turned on the cannons. First, I blasted the machines, the utility lines, and any police who tried to approach. I let all the families escape before I started in on their homes. Nobody had ever seen anything like it. By the time the authorities first tried to storm my house, most of the neighborhood had been destroyed. Houses were sagging, one crumpled, all the trees were down, water everywhere. On my portable radio, I listened to all the reports. Even the national services were doing stories, dissecting my character, talking about the quiet loner who suddenly went berserk. Only one reporter speculated on my preparation, how many years of patient labor it must have taken to prepare my flood. After the cannons had repulsed the first police attack, I replaced even Latin American wars and European economic crises as the lead story. The cannons have been going for 10 days now. My house has begun to sag and sink, but my pipes have all held, not a leak. The water pressure from my well is as strong as ever. Outside, past the rubble, the toppled trees in the new marsh, I see police cars and army vans. Soon I'll have to sleep. Then they'll get me. If not the first time, then the second, certainly. But I've done what I had to do. Outside, under a cloudless blue sky, the sheen of water reflects everything back to my window. I suppose that's kind of related to Kerry Tonkin's way. I'm going to read a poem. This is a poem. I was putting together this book, and Wayne wanted this book, but they wanted it a bit longer. So I went searching for poems that I'd sort of abandoned in the past, and then I asked a bunch of friends, at least a couple of them Michigan writers, to help me out, to speed up the process. So this was kind of a journal poem and that I did back in the late 90s. So the incidents from my life, which are pretty clearly in here, are from that time. And it's basically a poem about trying to write when it seems so difficult to write and, you know, what's the point anyway? So this may apply to somebody in the audience. And I've never read this in public before, so this is good. And it's going to be on the web, Peter. I won't be able to take it off. It's called What's Needed Now. There are 2 dates, one at the beginning, and then the day changes right in the middle of a sentence. So the dates are in there. What's Needed Now, May 31st, 1998. I am willing to let the impressions come with their various degrees of intensity, sometimes vague, sometimes as sharp and as multi-layered as Basho's haiku. The dog, alert, her ears twitching at the Sunday traffic on the street, the tops of the 3 black walnut trees in the neighbor's yard swaying in the gusts of wind hanging around after a thunderstorm blew through late last evening, the dull ache in my head brought on by late-onset allergies that's keeping me from any good reading, the tick-tocking of the grandfather clock out in the kitchen. Next week's my 46th birthday, and that will be exactly 11 months since I quit smoking. I've tried to blame this problem I've been worried about, the problem of focus, on a lack of cigarettes. Usually, I blame all the extra weight I'm carrying on the same thing, so I should be careful about where I look in my slightly desperate search for reasons. Right now, I'm watching a hockey game, Detroit and Dallas, of all places. So it's hard to concentrate on my inability to find a focus. Period's over, Detroit's still winning. Out on the back deck now, my mind a television glaze, but Detroit won, watching the dog half-heartedly to make sure she doesn't shit next door. The ground is littered with white peony petals battered off their flowers by a quick rainstorm that hit us hard this afternoon while Christine and I had taken a little break to make some daylight love upstairs. We were just coming when the rain started, one of those Shakespearean moments when the outside world, parched and hot, reflects the emotional condition of the people in the play. The heat's gone now. Broken. The air is fresh and light. A breeze rustles the oak leaves. So how does anyone maintain his or her focus? Not to write novels or to paint pictures necessarily, but just to think clearly about one particular thing, even a simple thing, extended thinking, or perhaps some long watching of something, anything, when dinner dishes must be washed and the dog walked. I've been closer in my past, and I remember how fresh I felt, like walking into a field after the first frost, or walking through a city at dawn, one where I couldn't speak the language and didn't need to. That all sounded a lot like closure, as if I were beating the drum at the end of some artistic thing, song or poem, and there isn't an end to this, unless, of course, I achieve an epiphany and learn, finally, the way to direct my mind and my imagination toward a particular image, whenever that image calls out for notice, when even the smallest thing, peony petal, jack in the pulpit, or bloodroot, robin, housefinch, or black-throated blue warbler, sings to me with the power of Gabriel's trumpet. June 1st, 1998, calling for the end of time or the beginning of some new, unimaginable moment. But today is just Monday, normally a day off for me, a time to sit around home, read, or download my email. But the other managers at Shame and Drum have all gone to Chicago for Book Expo, so I came into town to run the weekly and monthly reports and count the money into the cash drawers. But I'm grabbing some time, a few minutes, to sit in a coffee shop and count syllables and think about the deadness in my head and the focus I can't seem to find to bring me out of my narcissism and help me reconnect with the good things of this world. And this focus I'm belaboring here isn't just one of art, though trying to learn the art may have taught me the importance of this attention to small worldly things, the precious objects that surround us. And once knowing that attention, I miss it terribly when I can't force myself to give it. I can worry that I won't feel it again in this life. Just this morning, I felt the whisper of pain in my chest. I have already outlived my friends. David Bray dead for almost 13 years now. Mike Simpson for almost 10. And they were both in much better shape than me, chubby ex-smoking bookseller than I am. So I could drop at any moment, even on a bright and clear morning in early summer when I had to count money and prepare to read stories for an audience of high school juniors out at Huron High. I've expected it, the sudden blockage, stopped breath for years now. I'm amazed it hasn't happened yet. Now the day is almost over. I did the high school gig, mowed the lawn, swept the drive, and watched Faith and her friend. The day has been a good one, with lots of different tasks extending the hours. I'm in the backyard, listening to the birds, watching the sun play through the leaves. If I could, I would catalog the myriad shades of green, the green of spruce under oak, sunlight through silver maple. The Buddha might not approve, but I am clinging to this as if my life depended on it, which it does. It does. All this longing to end. It seems as if every page has its ending. I must fight the thing to keep going. It wants to stop, despite my plan, the form I see for it, which is this. Last Saturday, I did a talk at a writer's conference where all of us were given fancy tote bags in which were notebooks and pens. This notebook, this pen, though just an ordinary college spiral notebook, it has a surprising firmness to it, a sturdiness that attracted me right away. On the outside, it says there are 80 sheets inside it, which in my math means there are 160 sides in it, and I've been having this problem of focus, if you remember. Who is you, and where did he or she come from? Am I suddenly and rashly imagining that someone will actually read this? Will that imagined reader change things, or was he or she there all along, and I just couldn't face the thought? So for 24 hours, I kicked around the idea of filling all these 9.5 by 6.5 pages, all 80 sheets, that's 160 sides, with my search for this focus. But I'm just finishing up page 10 now, 1/16 of the project, and the thing has tried to end itself at least 3 times already, as if it were some kind of song or poem, some work of art that resolved everything nicely. That is not what I need now. So never throw old journals away, because who knows where it'll happen. Some poems getting toward the end here. This is a poem in 4 very short parts. It's called Walk. The parts are numbered, and each one of them begins with an ellipsis, dot, dot, dot. And in my image of this poem, the dot, dot, dot means a walk, that the title gets repeated. The only thing to say about this, it jumps around to several places in different times. The only place that might seem weird, I've got some names in the third section, East Station, Fields of Heaven, Place of the Star, which are just literal translations of their French names. And when English, it looks like I've gone Tolkien or something, and I'm in Middle Earth and you know, all those things. But really, if I were to just say Gare de l'Est, Champs-Élysées, and Place de l'Étoile, you'd sort of all know it was a real place here on the Earth. But since I translated them in English, it sounded suddenly mysterious. A walk. One. From that place in a hall in an old farmhouse, at the foot of a narrow stairway that rose up to darkness at the top, no one believes I can remember my first steps. You heard it from your family, they say. But I remember I was alone, and no one saw the things I saw. I know a man who remembers his own birth, I say, who remembers pain when he was pushed into his life. And I pulled myself upright by that stairway, turned and walked, uncertainly, of course, back to the living room and the light. Two. On New Year's Eve, after I snuck out of church, the watch night service, where my family watched minutes crawl, sang hymns, and prayed until midnight, and outside in air so cold it hurt to breathe, air that rose up dense and smoky around me, when I walked fast, faster over the snow, crunching back at me, until I was running, exhilarated, until the 12 bells chimed and the drunken godless yelled through their windows to the boy running by, "Happy New Year, kid," and all I wanted was to join the party. Three. Alone from the East Station to the river, then west through courtyards and the palace gardens, and somewhere here among the fountains, the sun finally broke through the trees, over the shops and hotels, onto the first old man reading his morning paper on a bench wet with dew, to the fields of heaven and all the way up to the place of the star. And I understood, or thought I did for a minute, maybe two, the notion that the sun might need one of us each morning, and this morning it might be me to bring it back over the crest with the power of our joy. And I returned to the river to stand in line before the sparkling tower. Four. In the Manistee National Forest, on snowshoes, probably 4 feet on the ground already and more snow falling, and I lost direction out in the scrub oak and jack pine, then wandered for hours, hearing only raven croaks and the deceptively close nuthatch calls, nasal and metallic, until I stumbled on a snowed-under, fire-access two-track road I vaguely remembered and found my way back to my friends, their cabin, their wood stove, and fire. I'll end with three very short love poems. It's been one of the regrets of my writing life that I have not had much success writing love poems, and the ones I've done all sort of seem oblique and move around it, around the issue. But I'll keep trying, since you know, it seems worth writing about, and you know, I've been in one relationship for 30 years. Whew, it's hard to believe, which seems worth celebrating. So these are sort of love poems that kind of work around the fringes of things, and maybe get there. All very short. All three very short. The first one is called "A Monk's Rule." For Christine. But for you, my love, I would take a monk's rule, rise long before dawn, have a simple breakfast of unbuttered toast and milk, one cup of coffee, black. I would go upstairs, sit with paper and pen, and plumb the deepest reaches of my mind or soul or self. Evenings, I would read nothing but books written in the first millennium. So that's kind of a weird love poem. The things I would do if you weren't there. You can see why my wife is suspicious of my love poems. Here's one I wrote. This is another one of our old journals. I kept this in a journal. I was working in a U of M program where we take kids in the woods for a couple of months out in New England and read Emerson, Thoreau, and things. And I'd get up at night and walk around the cabin in the dark, and I'd look back at this little cabin. And I wrote these lines, and then they sat there for a couple of years. And I came back, and I said, oh, wow, that's a poem about marriage. Who would have thought? So I put a title on it and changed the first line, and it became a poem about marriage. Good job. And I didn't know it, but it's obviously a poem about marriage. So, metaphor for the long married. Beyond familiarity, There is a small lighted space, comfortable, bright enough without blinding, warm enough for relief on a cold day. A small place surrounded by an interesting darkness where you travel at leisure, a place that glows at the edge of perception that always waits to take you back inside. And here's one, the last one in a poem to end on. You can see how I started this poem now a while ago. It takes a while for these things to come to fruition. After 20 years. We sat above the rocks below Big Sur one spring morning and watched snowy egrets dance, their breeding plumes arching backward as they raised their yellow feet hesitantly from the surf before he mounted her and egret generations began their tentative futures. Our kinship with snowy egrets was nothing grand. Perhaps we understood their single-mindedness and hoped they felt some kind of pleasure, too. It looked as if they did. Thank you. Thanks. Thank you, Peter. Great, thanks. Peter, you should get, actually, now that Bill's here, get him to sign that Kyriakakis, too, since his name's also on the page, so preserve him in the special, this is for the library, yeah. Does anybody want to ask me anything? If not. That and the Waters Prevail, that one I read? Yeah, it was published originally in that magazine Story, which I think you know about,
yeah.
Which was around for years and years and years ago. I was so pleased to have that story in that magazine. And then it's in this new book of mine, so which mixes poems and stories.
Yeah,
and
really
poems and prose.
Quite a story.
Good, glad you liked it. Glad you liked it. Yeah. That was a wonderful magazine when it existed. The woman who ran it, she could have sold it, but she couldn't bear with anybody else editing the magazine, so she let it die. What was her name? She was from Cincinnati. I forget her name. She and her husband own that company that does Writer's Market and things like that.
I thought there was a guy that always went around doing workshops that was involved with that too.
Could be. Yeah, it could be. I mean, they had. Gordon Lish?
Yeah.
No, he did his magazine quarterly, the quarterly. Yeah, which was around for a long time. Yeah, he would go down. He'd do these brutal workshops.
Right.
People would give stories, and he would spend half an hour massacring the first paragraph.
Right.
And people would be quivering and crying and go out of the room and be like, whoa, I didn't plan this when I became a writer. And they'd pay a lot for him to do it, right. They'd pay like $2,000 for the the pleasure of being massacred. So, yeah, it was weird. That in that one long poem, the writer's workshop that I went to and got that tote bag with the that was at Oakland Community College. So, and it was David James who set it up, got me down there. So, I wasn't going to stop and say that in the middle, but it suddenly occurred to me. Oh, that's where I came from. It was Oakland OCC. Well, I mean, it's a lot of it bleeds into lots of places. That first poem I actually read was a sonnet, and it was a sonnet that tried to rhyme in its first incarnation, but then I abandoned rhyme, although it's still 14 lines, and it's still pretty pentameter-y. The other thing that I use a lot to at least get me going are just simple syllabics. Often try to construct things as weird as Marianne Moore did, and she would say, okay, I'm going to write this poem now. And the first line is going to have one syllable, the second line is going to have three syllables, the next line is going to have nine, the one after that is going to have eight, the one after that is going to have six, and the last one is going to have five. And this poem is going to go on for 11 stanzas. And each stanza is going to have those syllable counts. So that, I mean, really, it's like, wow, weird. But it really worked. It worked wonders for her. She wrote some of the great poems of the 20th century that way. But it really does help when you've got sort of things that are falling into a poem and not quite there, that kind of almost arbitrary limits on yourself help, at least they help me. So there are several of the poems that I read here that are actually in syllabics, but that the you know, the rhythm you're going to get from that is only going to come from sentences. It's not going to come from stress. So it's hard to tell that it's in any kind of form. But it actually is.
There's something here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's not one that English lends itself to, but it's I found it helpful, and well, other people have too. So it's a good way of doing things. Yeah. Bill and I did a lot of those translations that we and well, partly because syllabics make more sense in Greece in Greek, but we counted syllables in a lot of those. So that poem I read, Sleep. Was 11 syllables and decasyllabic in the original, and we did it in 10, which gets it very close to being iambic pentameter, or blank verse in English. But it worked pretty well for that poem, I think. Not so successfully in other poems.
What's the name of your new book?
If the World Becomes So Bright. That's the one.
Is there a kind of theme that runs through your book?
Actually, Bill, I was thinking the term, the theme that runs through it is kind of a vaguely, desperately hopeful environmentalism. That was sort of in my mind, although it's never very explicit in it, that, you know, you have a kid, and particularly you name your kid Faith, which I did. You know, there's this hope that there's going to be something out there in the future when you have a child. You know, sometimes you feel you're talking yourself into it. And then when I revised it, Wayne State took the book, and those of you who do these kinds of things will... So I took the book, they gave me a contract for it, but the very nice editor there said, I wish it were 20 pages longer. So can you make it 20 pages longer in 5 months? Which is a short period of time to come up with 20 pages of poems that you feel comfortable about sending out in the world. So I did, and I enlisted a lot of my friends, Tom Lynch and Ray McDaniel, you may know those names. You know Tom, the famous Undertaker? October 30th, Frontline, Wednesday night. It's Frontline on Lynch. It's fabulous. I saw I pulled out my press credentials so I could see a preview of it. So put that on your calendar. So those guys read these poems that I was coming up pretty fast and told me what they hated, and you know, you can rescue this if you chop out these 15 lines, and you know, this one, don't do this. This will embarrass you. So I've never used friends like that to help with a book, but I did this time. So. And now I thought, Bill, when I put it there with these other poems that I put in there, that I really thought this was a book essentially for my daughter. And I'd written poems for it, I'd published poems for it, but I never really said, oh, this is a poem all addressed to my kid, you know. She's in a lot of the poems at different ages, and the idea that there are several poems where there's this vague, uncertain hope that is out there. Because, you know, Bill and I argue all the time because he's totally convinced it's all going to end tomorrow. The world's going to end tomorrow. And we keep arguing. We've been arguing about this for 30 years. Yeah, Bill, you may not know this about Bill, but he's
well,
you know.
I know.
I know you do.
Our offices are
mine. Oh, really? Yeah. He's got a gloomy side to him.
The
realistic side. So in that one poem, you know, if Bill died, I'd be upset because... And we argued all night about apocalypse and drank too much ouzo, and the Englishman got up. So that was that, Bill. Although that particular argument was a long time ago, neither one of us could drink that much ouzo now. We couldn't keep any Englishman awake, even if we wanted to. Do I miss the bookstore? I'm trying to say this some politely because at least there are three people who have lives in academia. I work pretty hard in the teaching I do now. But there's no way that compares to working in retail for a living. That's hard work. And, you know, talking to smart young people about poetry all day, that's pretty cool. That's a pretty good way to make a living. No, I don't miss the books. And the book business, of course, has gone through so many changes, and it's just such a weird space to be in right now with so many... different kinds of pressures. Nobody's making any money. And so, no, to tell you the truth, I don't miss the bookstore. You know, I miss being out there with people a lot, and I miss being out there with people who are interested in books and putting them in their hands. I do miss that, but still, it's not much. Yeah.
Well, thanks very much.
Sure. Thank you, guys. Enjoy your weekend.